It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Up next, the author of a new book about the Charleston Church Massacre in South Carolina that not just tells the stories of the men and women killed, the survivors, and how the community was impacted on that tragic day, but the impact since. The fourth anniversary of that shooting is this month. It was on the night of June 17th, 2015, and 21-year-old white supremacist Dylan Roof, as most of you know, gunned down nine congregants of one of the nation's oldest black churches during Bible study. Among those killed were the senior pastor of the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church and South Carolina State Senator Clementa Pinckney. Jennifer Berry Hawes is my guest. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and a special projects reporter for the Post and Courier of Charleston, South Carolina. That's the daily newspaper there. And her new book is called Grace Will Lead Us Home, The Charleston Church Massacre and the Heart Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And I want to start on that maybe controversial aspect that's the last word in your book title, and that is forgiveness. Forgiveness is a point of conflict in the book. Some people may remember that Nadine Collier, a woman named Nadine Collier, was the first of the family members to publicly express forgiveness to Roof. And so many Americans were at once so impressed by the rapidity of forgiveness coming from these church congregants to a killer of their friends and other loved ones, but also astonished that people would do that. Can you remind us of what actually happened there?
Yes, you'll remember that the morning after the shooting, Dylan Roof was arrested just outside Charlotte, North Carolina. And then the following day, he had a bond hearing. And at that bond hearing, four of the victim's family members spoke. And they spoke to him words of forgiveness and Christian themes of grace and mercy and love. And it was an absolutely beautiful, inspiring moment. Their words were heard all around the country and beyond. But the next day, someone discovered Dylan Roof's writings on his website, and we learned that he was a white supremacist, and we saw those pictures of him holding up the Confederate flag. And it was a really disturbing moment, but those two polar storylines really came to define this tragedy. And moving forward, as I got to know a number of the survivors and the victims' loved ones, I realized that the story was really much more complicated, that while we tend to lump survivors in groups. You have, you know, sort of the activist kids from Parkland. You have the forgiving black Christians in Charleston. They're really people are much more complicated than that. Their reactions were much more complex and different than many people realized. And that was a story that I felt had really gone untold.
The officials in government, much of the media, were quick to latch on to the forgiveness narrative. How did that look to you with 4 years of hindsight? And do you think they got some of it wrong?
I think that what they didn't realize was that the narrative of forgiveness would provide cover for people who did not want to discuss racism and the pervasive racial disparities that exist. So I certainly don't think they intended that. But I think the reality is that in the aftermath, that's what happened, is that we saw some smaller, more personal changes between people that attempted to bridge racial divides and understand our history in a more honest way. But if you think about it systemically, we did not see broad sorts of policy changes, for instance, that would address racial disparities. And we did not see in South Carolina, for instance, the legislature has not passed a hate crimes bill here still 4 years later. And that's something that's really disappointed the family members involved. So where that storyline is beautiful and inspiring on the one hand, I think it took some of the energy out of a conversation that needed to be had here.
You even say that some of the victims' families found themselves what they might describe as spiritually abandoned by church leaders. In what way?
Right. The survivors in particular, so bear in mind there were 12 people in the room when Dylan Roof joined the Bible study. And three of those people survived. One was a child, an 11-year-old girl, and two were adult women. And both of those adult women felt after the shooting that the church leaders really abandoned them. They did not come to their homes to minister to them, which is something that, in particular, one of the women, Felicia Sanders, desperately wanted. She wrote a letter to the interim pastor asking him to please come minister to her. She was really struggling. She had lost her son, her elderly aunt, other family members, and obviously people she'd gone to church with and loved. But for whatever reason, he never came to her home, and she was not prepared to go back to Emmanuel, to this site of this tremendous trauma she had witnessed. She wound up leaving the church. Interestingly, she left Emmanuel and went virtually right next door to an historic, predominantly white church. And that church, at one point, was the spiritual home of a man named Denmark Vesey back in the 1800s. Vesey left that church, which is Second Presbyterian in Charleston, and he went to Emmanuel, where he was a worship leader. Now, Denmark Vesey went on in 1822 to launch a massive slave rebellion in the city. Now, it was discovered by authorities, and Vesey was hanged along with about three dozen of his co-conspirators. So Felicia wound up going to the very church that he had once left, sort of closing an interesting historical loop. But the reasons that both of them left their churches was because they were looking for places where they were treated with dignity and where they could worship God freely. And so Felicia went to another church, and Polly Shepherd, her fellow survivor, did as well. Polly went to another AME church in town. But neither of them is at Emmanuel, and that's because they felt their spiritual needs were ignored.
My guest is journalist Jennifer Berry Hawes, whose new book is Grace Will Lead Us Home, The Charleston Church Massacre and the Hard, Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness. We can take phone calls for her as this book from this Pulitzer Prize-winning Charleston-based journalist is coming out now around the fourth anniversary of this massacre. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. What did you set out to achieve by revisiting this tragedy at this time?
I wanted to present a more complete picture of what happened here. The forgiveness narrative that I mentioned earlier really came to define the tragedy, and then also the racism that is, you know, still obviously an issue here and elsewhere. Those two storylines, though, were so all-consuming, really, of coverage. I watched journalist after journalist come to Charleston and write essentially one of these two narratives. But what I saw on the ground was very different. I saw a much more complicated story, as you mentioned, of the survivors leaving Emmanuel, but also of families dealing with divisions themselves, disagreements over how to handle the donations that poured in, disagreements over forgiveness itself and whether that should be extended to Dylan Roof, and what Christianity would teach about that. I saw a much more complicated and interesting story than I felt like was heard outside Charleston at all.
You were born and raised in Charleston, I see, so you're a part of that community. But you also write that as a white woman writing this book, you've thought a lot about the difference between empathy and shared experience. How does your particular identity inform your relationship to the story as a reporter?
No, let me say, I am not born and raised in Charleston. I was actually born in Tallahassee, Florida.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's fine. I grew up actually part of my life in Miami, part of my life in Atlanta, and much of my life in Chicago. So I've lived in a number of places, but I've lived in Charleston for almost 20 years now. So I felt like I had sort of an insider-outsider view. But I don't bring to this story the view of an African-American person dealing with the loss of a family member in a racist shooting. So what I was trying to explain there is that as a journalist, you know, I'm trying to tell this story through the eyes of the people who lived it. so that I'm trying to tell, for instance, what Felicia Sanders or Polly Shepherd felt like when they were standing outside Emmanuel trying to go inside to get a picture taken, and the church would not let them inside. That was just a terrible moment, but it's not one that I was telling through my eyes as a reporter. It was one that I was trying to tell through their eyes as people who were experiencing that. And that's what I was trying to explain in that passage you read, is that this is not a story about me or my perceptions. I have attempted to write a story about them.
The big symbolic political response to the shooting that people may remember was the removal of the Confederate flag from the State House grounds in South Carolina. The governor at the time, Nikki Haley, who had previously dismissed calls to take it down, made that decision. How has the shooting changed the city or the state, if at all, especially with respect to race?
Well, it's interesting. On the first anniversary, the University of South Carolina produced a survey. It does this periodically. And the survey asks the question of how people perceived race relations a year later as a result of the Emmanuel shooting. And bear in mind that about 2 months before the Emmanuel shooting in Charleston was the shooting of Walter Scott. And this was a shooting in which Michael Slager, a white police officer in North Charleston, shot and killed a black motorist who was unarmed as he was running away. And that video was caught on cell phone, so you know, the world got to see what happened there. And so in the aftermath of these two tragedies, the question was, have race relations improved? And I thought it was fascinating that many South Carolinians, most, said that they felt race relations had improved as a result. But most black residents polled said that no, they felt the opposite. And in fact, 30-some-odd percent of African Americans here said that they felt race relations were worse. And it was one of the highest percentages that that survey had measured. And so I think it showed the disconnect that continues to exist here, where people have really different perceptions. That said, there have been changes here. There have been more sort of personal, quieter changes. I'll give you one example. Polly Shepherd, the survivor, went to a church called Mount Zion AME, and Mount Zion is the daughter church of Emmanuel. And Mount Zion is right next door to another one of Charleston's historic white churches. And those two churches, Mount Zion and the other churches, Grace Episcopal, got together and they began holding a book study every Tuesday evening. And at these book studies, they discuss books and essays and whatnot regarding race. And so this produces a diverse group of 60, upward of 100 people at times, discussing books about race among people who otherwise may never really come into contact with each other, even though their churches sit right next door. Sunday here, like across much of America, remains the most segregated time of the week. And many, many systems in Charleston, you know, continue to operate in silos. And so that's one example of where there's sort of that personal change and a personal effort to get to know people who don't look like us. But systemically, we've not seen the sort of policy changes that address things like racial disparities and white supremacy and that sort of thing.
Calvin in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with South Carolina journalist Jennifer Berry Hawes, author of Grace Will Lead Us Home, The Charleston Church Massacre and the Heart-Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness. Calvin, thanks for calling. Hi.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me. You know, one of the things that I keep hearing about forgiveness, it always seems that the black community is expected to forgive all the time. Now, I never hear white journalists say ever to anybody else, hey, look, you know what? I need you to forgive. You know, 9/11 happened and nobody asked white people to forgive. So why always have the pressure for black people to forgive all the time? My friends and I found it outrageous when we heard that lady in South Carolina say, hey, look, I forgive. That's my point.
Calvin, thank you very much. Well, where did that come from? He suggests that it was prompted by a media question. Was that the case?
No. And he makes an important point that that narrative of forgiveness, many people felt like sort of perpetuated this plantation mindset that black residents should put on a happy face and move forward. But in fact, that line about forgiveness didn't come from a journalist. What happened was at Dylann Roof's bond hearing, the judge asked those in attendance if anyone would like to speak. And four of the victim's family members stood up and did so. And they all presented essentially themes of forgiveness and gestures to Roof of, wishing that he would repent, that he could be saved, extending their mercy, that sort of thing. So that wasn't prompted by a journalist. That was prompted by what they wished to say at that bond hearing to him.
And how widespread is Calvin sentiment within Charleston, South Carolina? We certainly talked about it on this show right after that expression of forgiveness, and it was controversial here right away, and from exactly the standpoint that Calvin was just articulating. Why is it always black people who are asked to forgive the transgressions against them when we don't hear other communities being asked after, other kinds of transgressions against them?
And I think that's an excellent point. You know, Ta-Nehisi Coates, the writer, tweeted out something along the lines of this after the shooting. He said, "Where was the campaign for forgiveness in the wake of the ISIS beheadings?" And I think that sentiment was heard quite a bit here in town. But I will say, from my perspective here, the words of forgiveness were widely embraced. And that's because Charleston is a very Christian community. South Carolina is a very Christian state. So that for people who are Christians, the utterance of those words that in their mind demonstrated the beauty of their faith were much appreciated. So it's complicated. Some people felt that it oversimplified and, as I said earlier, sort of gave cover to people who didn't want to discuss the realities of racism and white supremacy and the history of Charleston. But others felt that that those people who spoke did a remarkable job of living out their faith and of demonstrating that in a very public way. So given that you're talking about a very Christian city, I'd have to say that my feeling was, especially in the weeks immediately afterward, people really appreciated it. It also helped to keep pockets of violence from erupting. I think there was there were a number of groups who came to town trying to get people to act in more obvious ways and to demonstrate and that sort of thing. But the family members who spoke at the bond hearing didn't want that to happen. It wasn't that they didn't want people to protest, but they didn't want violence to erupt. Because as I mentioned earlier, keep in mind that the Emanuel shooting happened here right after the Walter Scott shooting. So mm-hmm. Everybody was on edge that the city was going to erupt into riots like we had seen around other parts of the country. So some people here, even if they disagreed with the words of forgiveness in the sense of wanting to not just move on so easily, they also were thankful that those words seemed to keep Charleston more peaceful in those days after.
But would it be fair to say no one was expressing forgiveness toward the cop who shot Walter Scott?
Right. Walter Scott's family had spoken in some similar themes, and particularly in terms of wanting to keep the city quiet and peaceful and all of that so that people could have more reasonable conversations. But yes, I think there's a really good question to be asked of what was missed because we were so busy talking about forgiveness.
Janine in Northern Virginia, you're on WNYC. Hi, Janine.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
I thank you for having this particular subject. I mean, I live in Clem Heights. My mom is from King Street, South Carolina. And she was a Baptist growing up, but she left the church when I was a child to become a Jehovah's Witness because she was so disgusted with the practices in the black church. And I feel like, and I'm currently agnostic, but there's a lot of intersecting emotions because when this shooting happened, it was one shooting that just hit into my core. The fact that they were worshiping and they welcomed him in. And I have intersecting feelings because I love certain parts of the black church as it's connected to community. but the level of secrecy and the level of dysfunction that is often on par, I think it's in all religions, but particularly with the Catholic Church. And what I want to know, I'm really happy that you wrote this book, and I say this in fear because as soon as a Black woman says that she's agnostic or that she's not religious, it seems that others in the Black community really feel distrustful of that energy, but I feel like it's important to name that. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just find out, because the women were ostracized from the church that they were shot in, and that the money practices they were, from what I'm understanding you said, that they were, the money was kept from them. And I'm just amazed at how they were able to actually still stay within the church and go to another church. Does your book discuss at all how the two women who survived were able to deal with the second trauma of what the Black church did to them, and how they were able to stay with Christianity even beyond that?
Jennifer.
Sure. The issues are complicated with the church, but I will say that and the book does discuss this, primarily the survivors didn't see that rejection or neglect as something that had to do with the greater Christian church. What they saw was essentially two human beings who didn't step up to the plate as they wish they had, so that their complaints didn't have to do, for instance, with the members of Emmanuel, who they loved. It had to do with the leaders of the church, who they felt didn't handle the situation appropriately. So when they left Emmanuel, they weren't leaving the church as a broader church. They were leaving Emmanuel specifically, and really more specifically, they were leaving those leaders. So they were able to separate the men who they felt had done them wrong from the broader church. And they're both still very, very active in their churches. So the issue has to do, I think, more with a leadership question, really, in that regard, than a faith question. For instance, with the donations, and this was a huge source of controversy here in Charleston, there were two funds set up. One was a city fund, and one was a fund within Emmanuel. The city fund, when it distributed its money, did it very transparently. They brought in pro bono attorneys, including at least one who had worked on the 911 fund, and they distributed the monies in a transparent way. Emmanuel, however, did not, and they felt that there was all kinds of secrecy. There was never an independent audit of the church's broader finances to find out if, in fact, all of the donations went into the fund that the church set up. And then also, when the church distributed the funds within its own fund, they gave slightly less than half to the nine families and then the additional survivor who did not lose a loved one. That generated considerable bad feeling, because the people who were suffering felt that the well-wishers who sent those millions of dollars in were not intending to pay money to the church. They were intending for that money to go to the people who were struggling and needed therapy and all of this. And I'll tell you one specific story has to do with Felicia Sanders, one of the survivors, a woman who grabbed her little granddaughter and dove beneath the table and played dead as her loved ones were shot and killed around her. When the church distributed its money, it distributed the same amount of money, sounds like, to every one of those parties I just described, but it did not give money specifically to the little girl. And so that was a source of great hurt for Felicia, because, you know, that little girl is the one who's going to have the longest journey forward in life, presumably, carrying this trauma with her. And to not give any of those donations to her was, and still is, a tremendous source of pain for Felicia. And she was able to remove that from her feelings about the broader church. She was upset with the handling of things by these church leaders specifically.
We just have 30 seconds left. How is another iconic moment from the aftermath looked back on now? And that is President Obama coming to one of the funerals and spontaneously breaking out singing Amazing Grace. The whole nation was moved by that at the time. I guess I'm curious if that is looked back on now with any ambivalence as maybe in this political moment an example of President Obama not expressing enough anger in a given situation?
You know, I've not heard that. What I've heard much more is from people who are appreciative and really loved his eulogy. In fact, I was talking with one young man who's now a state representative. His sister died in the shooting. And he told me that for his generation, he's in his early 30s, that eulogy was akin to Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech for an older generation of African Americans, that it was a speech that gave hope in a hopeless situation. And I think here, from my view in Charleston, that's much more how it's viewed. People appreciated the fact that he came. They appreciated the fact that he spoke words of hope, because that is for African Americans in a city that has dealt with a history of slavery and Jim Crow and generations of oppression, very welcome. That was a perception of his eulogy that I heard almost by and large here.
Jennifer Berry Hawes, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Charleston, South Carolina Post and Courier. She's now author of the book, Grace Will Lead Us Home, The Charleston Church Massacre and the Heart-Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.